Guardian Podcasts are partnered with audible.co.uk. For a free download, be sure to check out guardian.co.uk/audible, where Guardian listeners can choose any audiobook for free. See the page for more details. Hello, it's Music Weekly. I'm Alexis Petridis.
And I'm Kieran Yates.
Coming up, Jesse Ware gets serious about songwriting and Tom Bromley gets wired for sound. We've got three new tracks in Singles Club and another dip into Giles Peterson's worldwide record collection. All here on Music Weekly from The Guardian. Joining us this week... it's Michael Hann. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Alexis. You're looking slightly tired.
I am. I'm always tired.
Man. You must
I'm
be looking tired. Forward to your night going out raving in Dalston tonight.
I am. Well, this is what I'm keeping my finger on the pulse and my ear to the ground about what the young people like. I spent all week listening.
You stick
apart
with me,
from
Alexis.
Reviewing the Cheryl Cole album, all I've listened to this week is Junk Shop glam rock, because I've been writing about this book called Wired Up, which is about Junk Shop glam. And I sort of thought, well, you know, I need a break from listening to Hector and Hobnail and Muff. There's a Junk Shop glam band that were called Muff. There's another one called Dump. And there's one called Captain Skidmarks.
You look like the process of going between grime and the latest hip-hop happening rave has left you deeply, deeply exhausted and tired of life, though, I've got to say.
Well, you know, yeah, yes. No, I'm fine. What have you been up to? What's been going on? The Guardian today is printing a sort of list of the best albums of the year so far.
Sort of, yeah. An aid memoir, if you like.
What did you pick for that?
My favourite album of the year so far, but I wasn't allowed to write about it because you already did, was Django Django.
Yeah, it's a great record.
It is a great record.
Very good.
I sent over a load of singles from various people, which were basically just people that I've chosen for the podcast.
Yeah, you see, the thing is, that's considered best albums of the year. You could have sent them anything. I mean, you might as well have sent them, you know, a list of TV shows.
They said singles. They said just
oh, that's
send
a separate...
Over
yeah, there is single. No, there is singles in it as well, isn't there?
Yes.
I wrote about the Jam City album. I wrote about...
It's really good.
It's a bit tough on the ears.
Right.
But I think once you get into it, you know what I mean? It's very off-putting initially, but then you sort of listen to it, it draws you very much into its world. Has anything else been happening in music this week?
I went to see Hot Chip last night.
How Hot Chip?
I mean, I think that it sounded good if you're a fan.
Where was it?
Technically,
Heaven.
It was good. It was at Heaven, yeah. But we weren't greased up, unfortunately, or doing strip karaoke.
Not when they have ordinary gigs.
Yeah, no, usually. I've been to
it on a gay night.
Yeah, right. Have you done the strip karaoke?
No.
Right. But this was just for a gig.
Can we just repeat that question to Alexis again, just so we can all marvel
karaoke?
At it?
No. There's a club in Vauxhall, a gay club, called The Hoist, and it has a night called SBN. And SBN stands for Stark Bollock Naked, and that's the dress code. You've got to go to the club in the nuddy. Can you imagine? Amazing.
I'd feel self-conscious.
Brilliant.
Different world out there, man.
Brilliant.
How'd you get the night bus home afterwards?
There are changing rooms. You don't turn
right.
on
okay. that. It's worth asking. It's a practical consideration that many of our
indeed.
Listeners may have wondered about.
Well, there you go. How excited were you to meet Jesse Ware?
Very excited.
Tell me about it. Tell us all about it.
It was some of her singles that I chose for the singles of the year. Mm. Yeah, and she's sort of brilliant, doing lots of things and been quite consistently good, which is nice when you're a fan of somebody.
Yeah.
I know exactly
what you mean. Yeah, there's that awful sense when you invest something.
Yeah, that's right.
A lot. Into like the debut single, I was thinking this band are going to be amazing. And the next single comes out and it's shit, and you're stupid. You've gone told everybody about it, and da da da. So good for Jessie Ware; she's not put you in that position.
And also just sort of props to being quite forward looking, because she's, you know, what I brought in that Disclosure remix, which was very garage sounding, and then she does stuff with Julio Bashmore, which was very of the moment house sounding, and I think she just feels like she's really got the finger on her finger on the pulse.
The finger on her pulse.
Yes, on her. Apples.
Well, look, let's have a listen.
I'd stopped singing whilst I went to university, and much to my friends, she used to be so mean to me. Like, she'd be like, why are you not singing? I don't understand. And I'd feel so guilty. It just, I tucked the voice away, and then, you know, I wanted to be a journalist, and was busy trying to be a journalist for the Jewish Chronicle, and then thought I wanted to be a documentary filmmaker. And by being a collaborator, I mean, it was a really lovely way to ease me into singing again and kind of get my confidence up, because I really didn't think I could do it. And it started with my friend Jack Pignate asking me to sing backing vocals on a May Devel session for him for Radio 1. And you know, through having a YouTube where I'm featured, you can't even hear me in it, it's fine. Like, but I managed to send that to my mates, Man Like Me, and say, yeah, I think I can sing. And then they invited me to sing, and it was very organic. And then met Subtract through a friend of mine, and we did a session. It was the first session, and a song came out of it that then got released on Numbers. And I think there's been a lot of luck involved, but it's been really great to feature on dance songs, because actually I love dance music and I love female vocals on dance tracks. And so I was so happy to just be that. And then I got the opportunity to be a solo singer.
I think you're quite lucky, because your voice really translates into those different tempos, doesn't it? I thought that the reason that the Running Disclosure remix works so well is because your voice fits Garage quite well. You've kind of got that bit of that Jenna G type,
thank you
know,
you.
Thing
I love
going
Jenna
on.
G.
But then also, you know, that's kind of, you know, post dubstep, through lack of a better term, word. It kind of, you know, it sits quite nicely in those kind of tempos as well. So have you found that? Have you found that you were surprised at how well it fit on different
things? I was so happy when I got the remix through from Disclosure, who I love. The way they treated my vocals, everything, it was, I wrote to them, I said, thanks, you've let me be a garage, like, female garage vocalist, so, which I haven't done, so that's great, thank you.
And well, when I heard it, I was like, yes, there's a UK garage revival. But then you sort of moved a little bit away from that, didn't you, in your solo stuff?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm taking it seriously, the role of a solo singer, and I kind of, you know, I wanted my voice to lead it rather than the beats, and really focus on the songwriting aspect, and, you know, always have grooves and beat, great electronic elements in it.
Well, I think you can hear that you're definitely a product of kind of 90s R&B, 90s hip-hop. You know, you can hear that kind of En Vogue, Leah Tina Moore type thing in your voice.
Thank you.
You know, is that an adequate kind of observation?
Well, thank you very much for that. I'll take that. Thanks.
were you a big fan of 90s R&B? Did you have like black lip liner? Like,
no, I definitely didn't have black lip liner, but we used to listen to J-Lo's album, like, I'm feeling so good. Before we used to go out, and we'd be the girls in the music video before we'd go to a really kind of awkward private school party, and then, you know, we'd be listening to MTV Bass all the time.
Okay, so talk me through how it was working with Julio Bashmore, who of course at the moment is really huge, really huge in the house scene, and I think that house has really become the sort of tempo that you hear everywhere at the moment. It's really infiltrating club culture, it's everywhere. How did that come to be, and how has that sort of developed your sound?
Julio Bashmore is managed by my A&R, that Ben Palmer, who is PMR, and Ben said, oh, you should meet each other, you should, because, you know, either I was going to lend my vocals to a track on his, or we were going to write from scratch for me. And so I went down to Bristol, and I stayed at his house, and we hadn't really met, we'd met once, and it was all kind of quite innocent, and kind of, we sat, and his mum got us crudités and hummus, and we kind of got to know each other, and I was really scared, and didn't know what to do, and I didn't know what to write about, and it was when I kind of just started songwriting, I just was really nervous about saying anything, so we decided to write a song about Big Pun instead, which was the 110%, and it made it easier for me, so because I pretended that I was one of those girls in one of those Lucy Pearl or Big Pun videos trying to get Big Pun to dance, so that's what that was about. But I mean, you know, we wrote Running together, and we've written one of my favourite songs on the album called Sweet Talk, which I think it's really fun for Julio to be able to do songwriting, which isn't completely, it's not house, but it's still all his influences. He's really, he loves Prince, and Ballad of Dorothy Parker was, you know, a big influence on running.
Is that distance that you talk about where on songs like 110% it's not as self-referential and so you're taking that step back? Is that sort of how you deal with your more insecure moments as a writer, maybe?
For me, it was sometimes easier to pretend I was somebody else so that I didn't have to deal with something that I wanted to sing about. So it was either fantasy or kind of embellished situations. Definitely it helped for me. I've done it a few times on the album. I mean, there's still a story in there that is relevant to me and something that happened, but if I pretend I'm somebody else, sometimes I can push it a bit more. And you know, running is very melodramatic, and I tried to pretend it wasn't about me.
I love that kind of drama from the video, though, because it seems very performative, and it seems like you're performing a persona that's still a part of you, but, you know, you sort of switch on and off now and again.
Yeah, I don't really know what came over me on that video, because it was my first video, and I was so petrified. I remember just watching loads of Whitney Houston videos before going. We were shooting on a Sunday at my friend's restaurant, and It was actually really fun. I think I just wanted to look like a bit of a pop star, and so I tried to push it a bit far. But, and also I think I had to with that song. It's so, you know, it's very over the top.
High drama.
Yeah.
Is this representative of a day in a life with you?
I hope not. Definitely when I'm working, maybe. And when I'm on a video shoot, maybe. But no, I like
Your team are all sitting behind nodding frantically. Like, yeah, that's what she's like.
Yeah, no, I am. It's definitely a persona that I'm going back to cook at home, my boyfriend something, and it's I definitely won't be like singing into my wooden spoon when I get home.
Do you consider yourself as a pop artist?
I don't know. I consider like Lady Gaga a pop artist, and
right.
And I don't think I'm that, but I don't think I'm, you know, my songs on my album are all very underground. It's, you know, I don't know what I am really.
I think that you've sort of...
I like pop music.
Yeah, you've come from a place where you've sort of loved pop music and you've consumed it. So I think that it's natural that you can hear all of those influences. Yeah. But what I really like about you is that there is these pop injections of something that, yeah, like you say, really represents a very kind of London-centric scene. Okay. You know, it sounds like garage and it sounds like dubstep, it sounds like post-dubstep, it sounds like 90s R&B. And, you know, I think that it's quite a good reflection of that, rather than sort of having one temper that you stick by and you're like, nope, this is this. I think it's the kind of truest portrayal of that.
I mean, that's definitely what PMR let me do. I just kind of was through everything that I loved, whether it be hip-hop, you know, R&B, garage, everything, soul, and just had a bit of everything in there, and it's kind of worked out okay, I think, touch wood. Now if you're never gonna move,
Kieran there talking to Jessie Ware.
I'm intrigued to know more about her time in the Jewish Chronicle. I'm wondering specifically if she ever used to have to sub Paul Lester's Diary of His Divorce column.
Paul Lester writes a Diary of His Divorce column?
I don't think he does it anymore. I think while he was getting Jewish divorced, Chronicle. He did. I discovered this by chance at Mill Hill Waitrose once. It was trailed on the front page of the Jewish Chronicle. Paul Lester's sensational new column, wow. His Divorce.
Actually, that's a Hindu Chronicle you could write for.
Hindi Chronicle, the Hindu Times, song by Oasis. There must be a Hindu newspaper in...
I know, but they're not interested in what I have to say about that.
Really?
She got to write about bar mitzvahs in her area and stuff like that, she was saying.
That's brilliant.
Which is quite exciting.
But maybe that's actually really boring. Maybe it's like when I worked in the local newspaper in Aylesbury and, you know, reporting on like...
The Darby and Joan.
Yeah, I had to go to this old ladies' hats competition and stuff like that. So maybe that's the equivalent of that.
Yeah.
But, with better food.
I also work for my local paper. I did... there was like a charity event and someone made a model out of staplers.
A model out of staplers?
Yeah.
Or staples?
Staplers.
Because what would be good to do is make a model out of staples. Because I realised the other day, I looked in my desk drawer and I have a box of staples, right? That's like 1,500 staples box. And my dad nicked it for me from work in 1982. And, like, I've still got loads of staples left.
And you're dying to create something.
No, well, what I'm saying is it must be rubbish. If you're a staple manufacturer, it's just crap. Because, I mean, I use, you know, I work with paper, you know, use quite a lot of staples. Any staple manufacturers who are listening to the podcast, get in touch. Let me know how you keep hearth and home together. If one 1,500 box of staples will last a man. I was 11 years old when I got that box of staples. I'm 41 this year, right? 30 years that box of staples has lasted me. Anyway.
That's all from Staples Weekly from The Guardian.
I'm just interested. Singles Club is upon us. Michael, let's hear your choice. Together I'll sigh and then sigh. I'm tired of fighting the good fight. If you say the word, then I'll say goodbye. Forever I say you and me. Forever I try you and I. No, I'll never believe in their inside. Just another good reason to get it right. That's Forever by Haim. Michael.
Haim are pronounced Haim.
Haim.
I discovered. Three Los Angeles sisters and their mate.
Are they Northern Irish?
Haim. Their mate on drums, who for these purposes we'll call Sleeper Bloke.
Yeah,
to all intents and purposes, Trev. What he is. This is from their three-song EP that got released free online a few months ago. It's now being given one of your physical releases. Yeah. What's the point in that when everyone's always got it for free? But it provides an opportunity to talk about them. There was a lot of hugely excitable writing about this EP when it came
yes.
out. So the only three songs have opened. This revolutionary sound.
It was one of those songs when you read stuff and then you listen to the record. It's like I'd see no connection between what's been written.
Completely. Yeah. They were describing all the write-ups as, they meld West Coast folk rock with up-to-date R&B beats. And I wasn't hearing it either. I couldn't hear this Fleetwood Mac meets Nas thing that apparently it was. But the killer for me was going to see them live when they made their London debut at Electroworks 6 weeks or so ago, and they were absolutely breathtaking. I mean, you know how it is. When you go to a lot of gigs, and most of them sort of wash over you.
Sure.
But once, maybe twice a year, you get the one that has you going, wow, this is something special. Last year for me it was Django. Mm-hmm. This year it was Haim, who live... Well, you can kind of forget about the folk rock at all, delete the folk bit. Mm-hmm. They were
just rocking.
Fairly serious rocking proposition. They make sex faces while playing their instruments.
Wow.
Always the sign of a serious rock band,
sex
I think.
Sex faces.
What I'm really interested in, actually, with the recording, because I know I'm not really talking that much about this song here, is what they'll do next, because I think this was just such a limited sample and so unrepresentative of the whole spectrum of what they do.
I like it, actually. I was a bit nonplussed by the EP when I first heard it, just because of what was written about them, and I don't hear this at all. But actually, this track in particular has grown on me quite a lot. Kieran?
Yeah, I really liked it. I think you can hear that they must have charisma within it, and it sounds really upbeat. It sort of sounds like the kind of song that you'd play at the end of an American high school teen movie,
you know,
when all the girls find themselves.
Molly Ringwald should be dancing.
Yeah, but yeah, no, I really like that. It sounded a little bit Stevie Nicksy, but a little bit more upbeat and childlike. But yeah, no, I really, really liked it, actually.
Excellent. Well, look, three thumbs up for Forever by Haim, which is... I assume you can't now.
Haim.
Forever by Haim. I assume you can't get it as a free download.
I don't know. Might be worth looking on their website to see if you can.
Otherwise, you could spend some of your hard-earned cash money on the physical release of it. Now, moving on to Kieran's choice. That's Need to Know by Swindle, featuring Todd Lattee, who we had on last week.
Yep.
Didn't we? And Sam Frank.
Sam Frank is a vocalist that's done lots of stuff with Scream. He's a massive fan of the vocoder, so whenever you hear that, like, that's him. Swindle is a grime producer, first and foremost, who's done lots of work with people like Chipmunk and Asher D and Roll Deep. And he had two really big releases on Deep Medi and Butters called Playground and Mood Swings, which were really well received, really big tunes, as you would say.
Okay.
And yeah, I just absolutely love this. I love that sort of lulling, slow bounce, and then that, you know, sort of the weirdness, that kind of experimental weirdness that you get sort of now and again.
Is this what they would call a summer jam, Kieran?
I mean,
no, this isn't a summer jam, is it?
It's more of a slow jam, I'd say.
But a kind of weird slow jam. What's
a summer jam?
Summer jam is like my idea
funky
of a summer
house,
jam.
Funky house, I think.
Oh,
of.
No, I was thinking more like sort of 90s. You know, like Waterfalls.
Yeah,
or,
yeah, okay.
Like a Hey Mr. DJ by Jeanne or something like that. So I'm dropping, just okay. Hey, I'm dropping lyrical science here.
No, for sure. Anyway, yeah, but I thought it was really beautiful. Like, it's quite a beautiful love song, despite kind of being a little bit lewd.
Your records are always lewd, Kieran. They always contain references to intercourse. We can tell which person around the table here does not have children.
Yeah.
Frankly.
Gosh, yeah, you wouldn't blame
that. Terrific record, though.
I thought it was good. No, I liked it too. I thought it was very strange. It had a very odd ambience about it. It sounded like a... It's a creepy sound.
Well, strange and odd, but yet, because whenever I come on and I talk, I am unable to talk about Kieran's records because I don't understand the lineage they come from. But I can hear it in this. I can hear it going back through 80s R&B, especially, and back into classic soul ballads before then. I can feel the lineage, even as it's brought completely up to date.
Yep.
And I think the vocoder treatment is brilliant, using it as a melodic instrument rather than just an effect. I mean, I think that's when... those kind of vocal effects do work well when they're brought to bear on the melody, not just as, oh, that'll change it around.
Yeah. No, I agree. No, I thought it was good. I thought it was really good. So Need to Know by Swindle featuring Toddler T and Sam Frank. SoundCloud, is it?
SoundCloud.
Always SoundCloud. The next, which is my choice, is not available on SoundCloud. It's only available on vinyl. Let's have a listen. My mind falls over. It's Beyond the Wizard's Sleeve with Euros Childs of Gorky's Zygotic Monkey, formerly of Gorky's Zygotic Monkey, on vocals. It's called Daughter Tomorrow. I thought Beyond the Wizard's Sleeve had gone their separate ways. They are Errol Alkin and Richard Norris, formerly of The Grid, and now of The Time and Space Machine. And they put out some EPs a few years back that were sort of cut-ups. It's effectively applying kind of disco edit techniques to old psychedelic records like Pass Through the Forest by The Factory and a couple of Beatles tracks, actually. They did one of Hey Bulldog. And they were brilliant. They were really good. But they never seemed to develop that into making their own music. And now they're back, as they used to say in Smash Hits. And they appear to be doing their own music. This appears to be their own song, intended as a homage to The Left Bank. So we see the Baroque kind of thingy.
You know, I have strong feelings about the Left Bank and Senator. This is no Left Bank.
I really like it. It's out on vinyl only. It came out a couple of days ago. Back with another track, much heavier kind of psych track on the other side. This is actually the B-side of the single. There you go. I'm going to throw it open to the floor, and we'll start with Michael.
I like it, for all that it doesn't sound like a Left Bank, because it hasn't got harpsichords on
true,
it.
True,
if
no
it's
harpsichord.
Not got harpsichords, it's not the Left Bank. But Euros Childs is one of those enduringly charming figures of British pop music who brings this gorgeous, winsome melodiousness to everything he does.
Good voice.
Lovely voice for these kind of things.
Yes, and also got a hint of, always makes me think a little bit of Robert Wyatt when he sings, because he's got that sort of sad, there's something kind of childlike, and then the same as Robert Wyatt, but there's also something kind of quite sad about his voice. I was a big Gorky's Zygotic Monkey fan, actually.
He makes everything sound wistful and faintly lovely.
Welsh.
Did you remember that thing he did with Norman Blake two or three years
ago?
Which actually, the levels of Winsome Charm on that were so high that it takes you, turn it down, lads. Do a Judas Priest cover or something, you know.
Do Needle Up My Cock by Gigi Allen. They covered Michelangelo by 23rd Turn Off, didn't they, to keep the psychedelic theme alive. Kieran?
Yeah, I thought it was funny that you said that he sounds quite sad, because I think that he does, but also there's something quite comforting about this almost, isn't it, when I heard it, I was like, oh.
Comforts of melancholy.
Yeah, it feels quite warm and very Beatles-y. And also,
yeah, the strings in the background are very, very kind of like sort of Pepper-era Beatles. I think that's
yeah, definitely,
point.
Before they got cool and went to India. And also,
they've been to India.
Bit of Waterloo Sunset in there as well, I thought. It was good.
I like it a lot. I'd be really intrigued. I think that they're a good combination. Errol and Richard Norris, and I think they work really well together, and I'd be intrigued to see if they sort of spin this out into making an album.
Doesn't sound like it, but it kind of reminded me of Joe McAlinden out of Superstar.
Yes.
Who's got an album of his own out in a few weeks, which again one of the things I was listening to driving round.
It's very good, isn't it?
And yes, and this is generation of Celtic, especially west of Scotland, but with Europe as well, this generation of Celtic people who just knock out effortless psych-inflected pop, sunshine pop.
Yeah,
and you think, where does it come from, this inexhaustible well of melody in these people?
I think it's very true. I really like that Joe McAlinden.
Is it McAlinden? I've never heard it pronounced live.
I've never had it pronounced live. Rob Fitzpatrick brought his first... Lyndon, he records under the name of now, doesn't he? And Rob Fitzpatrick brought his first single as Lyndon into this show. It's very good. I think he's a owns a restaurant or something like that, doesn't he?
Does he? His records, sorry, we're getting a bit away from it, Euros Charts and Beyond the Wizard's Sleep, but his record's coming out, I think, on Edwin Collins' label.
AED, which is the new Edwin Collins and James Endicott's label. Mm. Edwin and his formidable missus.
Grace Maxwell.
Grace Maxwell. What a wonderful woman Grace Maxwell is. Anyway, we've got completely off the subject of Beyond the Wizard's Sleeve, featuring Euros Charles, Daughter Tomorrow. That's available now. It came out a couple of the start of the week. I don't know where you'd find it. It's probably quite limited. I know that Eastern Bloc in Manchester have vinyl copies of it, and you can buy it mail order. So there you go. Michael, you have been speaking to Tom Bromley, who has a new book out. Tell us about Tom Bromley, tell us about his book, please.
Yes, he has written a book called Wired for Sound, which is his account of 80s pop as seen through the eyes of someone growing up in the 80s and actually buying and listening to this music without cynicism.
Okay. Without prejudice.
I see what you did there.
Hey, pretty cool.
It's kind of, I guess, a sort of fever pitch for the 80s pop generation.
Okay. So let's hear what Tom Bromley has to say for himself.
Now, Wired for Sound, your book about 80s pop, isn't a critical analysis of 80s pop, is it, Tom? It's you trying to do for the now, that's what I call music generation, what Nick Hornby did for Arsenal in Fever Pitch.
It's a mixture, really. So it's partly memoir, and I'm trying to capture that sense of what it was like growing up listening to kind of music in the 80s and all those sort of listening experiences, whether it was listening to the charts on a Sunday night and kind of writing those down, or Top of the Pops, kind of smash hits, your kind of first Walkman. So there's a mixture of personal memories in there, but the idea of the book is then you then riff off that and then go on to kind of what I think are sort of the big themes about sort of music during the decade.
Now, you come down fairly firmly as a supporter of British pop in the book, especially the pop of the first half of the 80s. What for you is special about that era of pop music?
Yeah, I mean for me, the book is divided into two halves, and it works quite neatly in that at the end of kind of 1984 you had the original Band-Aid at number one with all the big names from the first half of the 80s, you know, your sort of Duran Durans and George Michael and Boy George and so forth. And then at Christmas 1989 you had Band-Aid 2 at number one with the lesser lights of the second half of the 80s. So you had your, you know, Jason Donovan and Bross and Wet 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 and people like that. I think the first half was the age, I suppose, it was particularly when I was growing up, but those were the bands who really, I suppose, captured people's affections. That was when sort of things like smash hits took off. The songs and the bands were kind of bigger and better. And in the second half ages, all those big bands sort of collapse around the same kind of time, actually, in sort of 1985, 1986.
Do you think that's just your perspective, though? I mean, people remember Duran and Spandau and Wham as huge bands. And yeah, Bros, their final gig was at Wembley Stadium, same as Wham's was. That's still 100,000 people there.
They didn't fill it, though, I don't think. I think it was somewhat less. I mean, George Michael and Wham were the smart ones. I mean, I think George Michael, probably out of all these figures, was the astute person who knew to kind of get out at the right time and kind of launch the solo career. So I sort of think sort of Band Aid was a pop record and Live Aid was a rock concert. And so those pop bands who were big and successful in the first half of the 80s, particularly with the help, I think, of MTV, that's probably worth mentioning as well, didn't kind of carry on that success and didn't have that sort of international success in the way that those bands did in the first half of the 80s.
There are ironies, though. You contrast the colour of British pop with the drabness of American AOR. But American AOR is what's won, isn't it? Thanks to Glee and so on. Every kid knows Don't Stop Believing these days, but none of them know Stand and Deliver or To Cut a Long Story Short.
I don't know. I think, you know, a lot of those early 80s bands, whether it's kind of the Human League, sort of Duran Duran, are still quite influential. I mean, you look at groups at the moment, like, you know, the latest Hot Chip album, for example, is very much kind of, you know, rooted in sort of 80s kind of pop and sort of 80s electronica. I think, yeah, certainly the kind of the 70s music in America at the end of that decade was fairly sort of monolithic and quite drab. I mean, I say in the book, you have this, you know, part of the American system where a lot of the bands are literally named after kind of places they come from. It's that kind of bereft of imagination. So you have your, you know, Chicago and your Kansas and these kind of bands. And you have this thing as well in America, the sort of anti-disco movement and the sort of culmination in the Disco Demolition Night, where sort of, you know, tens of thousands of rock fans, you know, gathered together in this baseball stadium and kind of blew up sort of thousands of kind of disco records. So I think, you know, America was certainly in a very different place to where sort of Britain was musically. And I think when MTV sort of started in 1981, these sort of American rock bands weren't interested in video and interested in the kind of, I suppose, the visual side. And so that's where the British bands kind of came in and kind of filled a gap. And that's partly, I think, why they were so successful.
Now, you're pretty unforgiving about the second half of the 80s. You note that Duran and Spandau and so on were inspired by Bowie and Roxy. And then you contrast that with the Stock Aitken and Waterman roster. But in a way, isn't that a comment on the new pop generation themselves? You know, that they couldn't actually inspire anyone from the next generation. It did take another 20 or so years for the influence of those groups to start coming through in the mainstream again.
I think, I mean, inspiration comes in different ways. And I suppose at the end of the 80s, the big influences were things like acid house and hip-hop and also sort of Manchester as well. So, you know, the Stone Roses and sort of Happy Mondays and bands like that. And I suppose what happened was someone like the Stone Roses or Happy Mondays, where the bands are kind of fused, kind of dance and rock together in the way that I suppose the electronic bands had done at the start of the 80s. And that's where the sort of next kind of creative burst kind of came from. And yeah, sure, I think at the end of the 80s, I thought sort of pop had kind of slipped back down pretty much to where it was in, you know, sort of the mid-1970s. I mean, you watch those kind of repeats of Top of the Pops on BBC Four of 1976, and sort of pop music was in a kind of dreadful position. And it had gone sort of back round to that, I think. I mean, you had things like Jive Bunny, for example. You had sort of Cliff Richard singing on the second Band Aid single. It was all very, very safe and very twee. And you had sort of Jason Donovan covering, you know, sort of songs from the 50s and 60s. It lost its kind of impetus and lost, I suppose, its kind of inspiration and drive.
Well, why do you think that happened?
I don't know whether it's part of it when music was cheaper. I mean, the way that, I mean, I think one of the things I argue about in the book is the way the sort of technology has a kind of big impact. And certainly in the first half of the 80s with, you know, with sort of the arrival of kind of synthesizers and drum machines and that kind of thing. And that certainly made music quite accessible. And so it meant that you could have this production line system where Stock, Aitken and Waterman could come up with a whole roster of bands and knock the songs out very quickly. And I suppose that was the more kind of commercial end of what bands like, I don't know, some Mars or kind of Bomb the Bass and those kind of people were doing, who were using the kind of same skills and kind of, I guess, kind of musical sort of technology in a sort of interesting kind of way. But I mean, there was good pop at the end of the 80s as well. You know, someone like the Pet Shop Boys, for example, were kind of this, you know, sort of beacon in the darkness, I suppose.
You make the interesting point about the big rock bands. I'm talking in terms of sound, not necessarily in terms of their ability to fill stadiums. The big rock bands who came from the British Isles in the 80s being products of the disenfranchised margins. You know, U2 from Dublin, Simple Minds from Glasgow, The Alarm from Wales, Big Country from Scotland. A quarter of a century on, and that kind of music doesn't seem to be the music of disenfranchisement anymore. You look at Coldplay, and it's the music of the mortgage payment. How did it go from being a voice of the dispossessed to the comfort music of the people with coffee tables?
Well, I think part of the answer probably is where the bands came from. And I think sort of if you're growing up in Guildford, you're not going to make this big bombastic kind of stadium rock sound that, you know, U2 or Simple Minds or The Alarm came up with. I mean, I think, you know, I grew up in the north, I grew up in York, and there was definitely, you know, this sense of kind of the north-south divide and this feeling that those kind of bands were kind of our bands and they were different and kind of standing up against, I suppose, a band like Spandau or kind of going on something like sort of Five Star, you know, felt more the kind of sound of, you know, London and sort of, you know, sort of Thatcherite kind of Britain. And I think one of the interesting, I mean, I'm sort of interested in kind of music and sort of landscape. I think there's an interesting discussion about how where you grow up and where you record music kind of influences where you're, the sounds that you produce. I mean, I talk in the book about the Unforgettable Fire that U2 recorded at Slane Castle. And I think that kind of sense of space and recording in those kind of surroundings certainly impacted on the music that they were making. I mean, the other thing, I remember when I was reading John Harris's book about Britpop and Oasis, that when the first Oasis album came out, the sales down south were kind of very slow, but the record shops were having all these phone calls from, you know, sort of Liverpool and Manchester and just saying that the sales are going through the roof. And it's quite easy to forget that, you know, sales of different types of music aren't uniform across the country. You have different kind of music will have a bigger impact in sort of different kind of areas. And certainly I think at stadium rock and those kind of sort of bigger sounds had more of an impact, I think, sort of beyond London and the sort of metropolitan kind of sound. And I suppose the other thing to say as well, in comparison with thinking, just going back to Coldplay, is that the 80s was a far less ironic decade. I mean, I think it was a decade where bands were kind of straight and you could sing about politics or you could sing about big ideals without anyone being kind of cynical and feeling that it was knowing. And I think Coldplay are probably, you know, playing in quite a sort of different environment now.
Also, though, one realises how much of the success of those big bands depended on accidents, on Bono's Live Aid stunt working for TV, even as the band thought it was a disaster, on Simple Minds reluctantly recording a song written by an outside songwriter for a film soundtrack, it not being the result of utterly ruthless planning. It seems quite a distant and innocent age in that respect.
I mean, interesting actually that the Bono incident you mentioned at Live Aid wasn't off the cuff. It was something that he'd done, pulling someone out of the crowd throughout their tour. The difference was that when they were playing their own gigs, I think the audience were closer to the stage, so it didn't take as long to go down and get the person. But obviously, at Live Aid, you had this sort of jumping down, like you were, you know, he was on Donkey Kong or something, kind of reaching down to the audience. But yeah, those moments of accidents kind of happen throughout. I mean, I think the Human League is a good example, when they kind of split in two, and the sort of musical half of the band went off and formed Heaven 17. You're left with Phil Oakey and the director of visuals. But that was the moment when they got in, you know, the female singers, and that was the moment when they sort of grew and became the band that everyone kind of knew and loved.
That's Michael talking to Tom Bromley. Wired for Sound is out now. It's published by Simon and Schuster. That's all we have time for, but there's more on the Guardian Music website, because this week we have the second of our Sounds of Europe series, where the wonderful Giles Peterson comes in to tell us about his favourite continental sounds. This week, Giles is giving us a whistle-stop tour of the Netherlands. You'll find it on the Music Weekly page. Thank you very much for joining us, Michael. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
It was a pleasure, Kieran. Lovely as ever to see you. You and I, we're back next week. Keep leaving your thoughts at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly and have a great weekend.
Guardian podcasts are partnered with audible.co.uk. For a free download, be sure to check out guardian.co.uk/audible, where Guardian listeners can choose any audiobook for free. See the page for more details.